I brought some more books. What's that one doing here? The Crystal Skull by Richard Garfield. Relic of the Lost Civilization of Atlantis? Can you get in on the Crystal Skull there? Now, that's not that crystal that was taken out of those metallic hands. There's another one. But we can wait for a while before we explore that one. People running around trying to find Charles Berlitz's most recent book, Atlantis, the Eighth Continent, which we've been looking at and we'll get back into. We'll remember he wrote an earlier one. If you can't afford the big hardback, he wrote an earlier one. He's not a bad writer, Charles Berlitz. And I've been reading from The Devil's Triangle 2, haven't I? As I told you, there are over 5,000 books on Atlantis. Here's the one by James W. Mavor, Jr. He's the one that's sure it's on the island Terra in the Mediterranean. Don't bother to read it. He's wrong. And then there's Jürgen Spanet, Atlantis of the North. He puts it up in near Heligoland. And then here's the tomb of the century. Atlantis, that have muscles to lift it, by Stacy Judd. He locates it in South America. But nobody's trying to locate it too far away. Well, some are. But consistently we return to the Atlantic Ocean. Now, where did it get its name? Don't bother talking about that one. Let's go back to what I was reading yesterday. Are you interested? Now, I know you've been here for several hours, but that wasn't very persuasive. You didn't sound very interested to me. There's the mist, the black mass. Shall we? Or shall we not? Now, everyone who gets frustrated easily, turn a knob. You are watching the wrong channel. If you want to listen to a TV evangelist preach against smoking, obviously you're watching the wrong channel. I got so mad at the TV evangelist on Sunday. There goes this one again that's dumping on people. He had the temerity to say that God doesn't hear the prayers of Jews. You understand what I just said? About time somebody come along Jesus was a Jew, and he taught us to pray. And forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven. And the reason they go to the Wailing Wall is because God gave them a promise that if they would go to that place in Jerusalem and pray, God would hear them from heaven. That word is forever settled in heaven. God doesn't hear the prayers of a Jew. You know, I could spend the whole night just being upset. But I decided the real counterpoint to the Sunday dopes is to keep on trying to find people of intelligence and pursue what I do on television. I'm telling you, I've said ever since I've been on television, you don't have to be afraid of truth. Because all truth leads you to questions that only God can answer, or to answers God's already given. Now, this Bermuda Triangle is something else. Why is Haiti the seat of devil worship? Well, let me go back to this. I just really think we ought to get this out of the way. The coffins that danced. Before we get back to the Bermuda Triangle and ships and divers and pyramids and crystals, I'm trying to make a point. And the point is, some strange goings on are in the territory known as the Bermuda Triangle. Now, a lot of people didn't listen Sunday. Can I bore you with the prelude to this story again? If you are nice, I might get past where I was. In Barbados, between 1811 and 1820, there occurred a series of events so bizarre, and I'm reading from The Devil's Triangle 2 by Richard Weiner. You ought to be able to find it. It's cheap. Go buy it. In Barbados, between 1811 and 1820, but you may not be able to find it either. In Barbados, between 1811 and 1820, and it's really hard for me to not spend the night just reacting to the event. But I'm going to resist. In Barbados, between 1811 and 1820, there occurred a series of events so bizarre and sacrilegious that witnesses were totally baffled by what they had seen. The May 1945 issue of the Journal of the Barbados Museum and Historical Society contained a documented account of this unsolved mystery. You say, what's this got to do with Christianity? Why is my microphone banging every time I move? Good. You can move it. Why am I reading this? Well, number one, I'm making a simple point. Strange things happen in and around the Bermuda Triangle. Are you getting that message? Have I sort of gestalted that? Second, if you know your Bible, the Bible will give you an explanation of this mystery. And I love to find things that can't be explained. apart from God and the Bible. There was a crypt there in Barbados, on the southern coast of Barbados, overlooking Oyston's Bay, in Christ's Church graveyard. The crypt, slightly over 12 feet by 6 feet inside, is constructed of coral blocks, cemented together so tightly that the walls appear to be a continuation of the lower portion, which was hacked out of the solid coral rock upon which the cemetery sits. The single entrance was sealed by a huge block of blue marble that weighed nearly 1,000 pounds. Now, I promise you that I will finish this story sometime tonight. You got my word. Now, I ain't promising I'll finish all the others, but I promise you I'll finish it. You're still with me? You've been here for so many hours. You still alive? It's late now. We'll have a ghost story. Plus the fact, Halloween ain't that far away. And do you realize we're going to be talking about a crypt again? We're going to be back to Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And that rich priest. The crypt, slightly over 12 feet by 6 feet inside, is constructed of coral blocks cemented together so tightly that the walls appear to be a continuation of the lower portion, which was hacked out of the solid coral rock upon which the cemetery sits. We said that before, didn't we? Twice. The single entrance was sealed by a huge block of blue marble that weighed nearly 1,000 pounds. When sealed, the tomb was virtually impenetrable. Now, if this story had occurred in Gridley, California, I probably would not be reading it tonight, even though it would intrigue me. But the facts are, it did not occur in Gridley, California. Barbados. In Ye Old Devil's Triangle. Yamacraw Land. When sealed, the tomb was virtually impenetrable. In July 1807, a casket containing the body... This is a scary story. Of Mrs. Thomasina Goddard was deposited in the vault. Interesting way to characterize the occurrence. A year later, another coffin holding the remains of 2-year-old Mary Ann Maria Chase, who had died of one of the many childhood diseases so prevalent in those days, was placed alongside the one holding Mrs. Goddard. For the next 4 years, the crypt remained closed. Then Dorcas Chase, little Mary Ann's older sister, was interred on July 6th . We have all the sound effects that go with the ghost story. Some people want me to try out a new microphone. It worked very good Sunday morning. This is our first attempt to try it here. We'll keep working with it. It sort of adds some spooky sounds to go with the ghost story. For the next 4 years, the crypt remained closed. Turn me up just a little bit. Then Dorcas Chase, little Mary Ann's older sister, was interred on July 6, 1812. It was rumored that the young girl had died of self-inflicted starvation as a result of differences with her tyrannical father. The Honorable, you can turn me down a little now, Thomas Chase. Find a halfway between where you are now and where you were. Not in the crypt, but on the microphone. Just a month later, Thomas Chase would follow his daughter to the grave, that number 4 deposited. It's a big, big crypt. 12 feet by 6 feet. That's a sizable little crypt. That's about from the clock to you, and from the edge of this to you. That's a pretty good size place to lay some bodies down. 12 feet by 6 feet, they all probably were 6 feet or less, and 2 feet for just laying on the floor without putting anybody on top of anybody. You could get six of them in there. So, you know, I don't want anybody getting sympathetic. They weren't crowded yet. Number four, Thomas Chase would follow his daughter to the grave. After the huge marble slab, 1,000 pounds. After the huge marble slab was removed, lantern-carrying graveyard workers descended into the chamber to ready it for the deposition of Thomas Chase's body. It took only a few seconds for the laborer's eyes to adjust to the semi-darkness in the tomb. Without taking time for a second look, they fled in terror. Because they were slaves, nobody believed them when they tried to explain what they'd seen. Finally, the rector, good old reverend of Christ Church, the Reverend Thomas Orderson, entered the burial room to see what had shaken the workers so much that they chose punishment for insubordination rather than re-enter the vault. When the good reverend entered the tomb, he was awestricken at what he saw. The caskets were completely disarranged. The one that contained the remains of the Chase infant was standing head down in the corner opposite where it had originally been placed. That of her older sister was turned end for end. The coffin containing Mrs. Goddard was lying on its side against one wall. Blasphemous desecration, screamed Reverend Orderson. It was at first believed that the sacrilege was the work of dissident slaves. However, the slaves were more frightened than were their white accusers. Because the Honorable Thomas Chase was apparently not so honorable, in fact, he is one of the most disliked men on Barbados, the blacks were sure the forces of evil, more powerful than man, had cast the coffins asunder. The caskets were rearranged back to their original positions. The body of Thomas Chase in a huge lead coffin that required 8 men to handle was placed in the crypt. The Reverend Orderson made a last-minute inspection of the vault's interior to ensure that everything was as it should be, then ordered the huge block of marble positioned back in place, sealing the tomb. Am I boring you? For the next 4 years, it seemed as though nothing had occurred in the Chase vault. The cemetery workers returned to their chores at the sugar refineries or cane fields, except when their services were required at the graveyard. England was at war with the United States. Ships came and went. 1816, the War of 1812 had been over for a year. Most of the young men impressed into the Navy returned home. And on September 25th of that year, little Samuel Brewster Ames died shortly before his first birthday. Again, the huge marble slab, 1,000 pounds, was hoisted away from the entrance. The Reverend Orderson, lantern in hand, was the first to enter the repository. As the lamp's glow flooded the chamber, the Reverend once again found the coffins in a state of disarray. The islanders were furious at this desecration of the dead. And as before, the blacks were accused of the deed. They always get it. Especially because of the numerous slave uprisings in the previous April. After the first furor was over, the Reverend Orderson climbed among the scattered coffins. There had been no attempt to open the caskets. Thus, grave robbery was discounted. The one containing Mr. Chase could have been removed or moved, rather, by no less than half a dozen men. Took eight to put it in. Takes six strong men to handle it. It was lying on its side on the opposite side of the crypt. From where it had been originally placed. The other coffins had also been strewn about. After the slaves replaced the coffins in their original positions, the Reverend, accompanied by Major Finch, secretary to the governor, examined the tomb and found nothing structurally amiss. The Ames child's body was placed in the crypt, and with great care, the marble slab was lowered back into place. The heavy A-frames that were used to position and lower it were removed. To test the door, 1,000 pounds, eight large men tried to shift it, but it wouldn't budge. The mourners departed assured that everything was secure at the tomb. 52 days later, the vault was again ordered opened. Samuel Brewster, the father of the little boy previously entombed, was to be the next occupant. He had been murdered by his slaves during the April Revolt and temporarily buried at the parish of St. Philip elsewhere on the island. The big A-frame was erected in place above the marble slab, 1,000 pounds, a block and tackle rigged, and with great effort, a dozen slaves hoisted it, 1,000 pounds, away. This time, the Reverend Orderson, entered the Chase vault, accompanied by the governor, Lord Combermere, and a magistrate. We'll get the bureaucrats in on this. Even before they entered, they knew something was again amiss. The crowd of onlookers gathered around the entranceway pushed closer. Four of the five coffins were strewn about inside the crypt. Only Mrs. Goddard's badly deteriorated wooden coffin remained in place. The others were made of lead. To move them around, they wouldn't disintegrate. So they left old Lady Goddard sort of standing there. This time, not only the blacks, but also some of the whites were beginning to think that the vault was cursed. I only have one point to make. Some strange goings-on around the Bermuda Triangle area. The following day, the coffins, including Mrs. Goddard's, which was to be bound with rope to keep it from falling apart, were removed from the crypt and placed on the ground outside while Reverend Orderson and three other men scrutinized the vault. Every part, both inside and out, was checked and rechecked for any possible entryway. Hey, I ain't telling this story. I'm just reading it. The search proved there was no way to get into the vault without removing the heavy slab, 1,000 pounds. And since a wooden structure would have been required to do so, anyone attempting to remove that slab would have been noticed. There was no indications of water having entered the tomb. No earth tremors or other natural disturbances had occurred. All of the adjacent structures were undisturbed. The men could find no way in which an unauthorized entry could have been gained. The caskets were placed back in the crypt and stacked in their original order, with the exception of Mrs. Goddard's. Bless her sweet soul, which was stood on end in a corner. Now, the moral of that is, if you don't get buried in strange places, get inside lead. Sam Brewster's coffin was laid to rest with the others. Now we got a new occupant. Again, the slaves lowered the marble slab into place, leaving the house of the dead sealed off from the rest of the world. This is where I think all bureaucrats should be crammed in death. Again, the slaves lowered the marble slab into place, leaving the house of the dead sealed off from the rest of the world. Or at least this world, anyway. Cement was now applied all around the slab where it came into contact with the tomb. Sealed. Word of the strange happenings in the Christ Church sepulcher had spread throughout the West Indies, even as far north as Florida and the Bahamas. Hordes of sightseers converged on Barbados to look at the enigmatic Chase Vault. Ships sailed many miles out of their way so that their passengers and crews might go ashore at Barbados and visit the graveyard. The people of Barbados bode their time awaiting the next funeral. As did Mrs. Thomasina Clark, a relative of the Chase family. Mrs. Clark went about her daily chores, unaware that it would be her body for whom the tomb would be next opened. On July 7th, 1819, the wooden A-frame lifting device was again erected, and the heavy marble block, 1,000 pounds, readied for removal from the entrance of the infamous depository for the dead. Government officials carefully examined the cement that had been applied to the joint between the marble slab and the doorway to the vault. No indication of disturbance. The onlookers crowded around the site were disappointed when informed that the entranceway was undisturbed. Nobody had gone in. Crowd gathered for nothing. They wouldn't see anything. But their disappointment was not to last for long. The blacks heaved on the block and tackle, but the big marble slab wouldn't budge. It was as if some force on the inside was causing the block to resist movement. The stonemasons double-checked to be sure they'd removed all the cement. Finally, with the help of wooden wedges driven by sledgehammers, the block began to move. The onlookers, crouching to get a better look, then saw what had impaired the attempt to clear the entryway. Richard Weiner wrote a previous book entitled The Devil's Triangle. That's The Devil's Triangle, too. The most famous event is described by him rather graphically. I can go back to the vault. December 5th, 1945 was a typical South Florida winter day, variable winds, a chilly morning, and a balmy afternoon with clear skies. Fort Lauderdale Naval Air Station, now Hollywood Fort Lauderdale International Airport, was a bustle of activity. Now I'm in The Devil's Triangle by Richard Weiner, the original one. I was reading two over there. You should always read one if you're going to read two. World War II had been over nearly 4 months. In addition to the permanently based ship's company and those assigned to the base for TBM, that's Torpedo Bomber Medium School, there was a large complement of Navy and Marine personnel awaiting discharge. The headlines in the Miami Herald that day read, CIO splits with Truman. I don't really care about that. The weatherman had forecast a temperature drop to 38 degrees for the following morning. Three Marine gunnery students at the base, Sir Roger Robert Gallivan of Northampton, Massachusetts, that's what happens when I try to hurry up, Private First Class Robert Grubel of Long Island City, New York, and Corporal Alan Costner of Kenosha, Wisconsin, couldn't have cared less about politics or tomorrow's weather, neither do I, as they returned to their barracks from the mess hall after lunch. The subject of their conversation was being home for Christmas and whether to attend the first or second show at the base theater that night. The picture was What Next, Corporal Hargrave, starring Robert Walker, a movie they'd never see. All three were scheduled to participate in a training flight that afternoon with a squadron of five Navy TBMs, torpedo bombers, also known as Avengers. Having over an hour before they were to report to the flight line, the three Marines decided to sack out in their bunks for a while. When it came time to leave the barracks for the operations building and a pre-flight briefing, Corporal Costner had a strange premonition not to go on the flight. To get himself excused was no problem, because he had already completed his required flight time for that month. Bob Gallivan and Bob Grubel, along with 12 other Marine and Navy flyers, reported to the operations center. The mission of the day for Flight 19, and you've already figured out this is a more detailed account. I had some calls from Tulsa earlier saying there was a recording of some of the radio talk. Yes, I know. And from all the sources, including Costner, who didn't go, Richard Weiner puts the events together. The mission of the day for Flight 19, as the squadron was designated, was a routine navigation exercise. Little did any of the six Navy and eight Marine airmen realized that their operation was to climax in what the Navy would later refer to as one of the strangest unsolved mysteries of the sea. 24 years later, Alan Costner returned to Fort Lauderdale to participate in a documentary film about strange unsolved mysteries of the sea. As he was exploring the old Navy buildings now used as a junior high school, he pointed to one as looking familiar. The boys' physical education locker room was the old barracks in which he was billeted, along with Gallivan, Grubel, and most of the other enlisted men of Flight 19. As Costner walked past the row of lockers and benches, he was silent, in deep thought. The windows being painted over rendered the building darker than normal inside, and when he walked out into the sunlight, he squinted and muttered, "For some strange reason that I can't explain, I decided not to go on the flight that day." For Sergeant Gallivan, a veteran aerial gunner with 3 years of Pacific combat duty, this was just another routine flight. To Private First Class Grubel, with less than a year in the service, this was another wonderful opportunity to fly. His buddies nicknamed him Yo-Yo because of his eagerness to fly whenever he could. His goal in life, however, was to enter the priesthood after his enlistment expired. He had just written home that he would see his family at Christmas, Mass, in a few short weeks. Flight 19 was under the command of Lieutenant Charles C. Taylor of Corpus Christi, Texas, the six-year Navy veteran. Flying with him in the lead plane were Aviation Radio Man Third Class Walter Parpart and Aviation Ordnance Man Third Class George Devlin. The two enlisted men were from the same Brooklyn neighborhood. The other pilots and their crews were Ensign Joseph Bossy of Arkansas City, Kansas, Seaman First Class Herman Thielander of Kimbrough, Minnesota, and Seaman First Class Bert Vallock of Bloomfield, New Jersey. Marine Lieutenant Forrest Gerber of New Ulm, Minnesota, and Private First Class William Lightfoot of Lexington, Illinois. Costner was flown as a gunner in this plane. Marine Captain George W. Stivers of Piedmont, Missouri. And Marine Captain Edward Powers of Mount Vernon, New York, Staff Sergeant Hal Thompson of Chicago, Illinois, and Staff Sergeant George Paonessa of Mamaroneck, New York, made up the total crew. It was 1:30 p.m. when the five pilots and their crews reported to the flight line for a pre-flight check in their respective planes. The Avenger was one of the largest and most powerful single-engine propeller planes ever built. It was used from both aircraft carriers and island bases. The wings could be folded back for carrier use. It had a wingspan of over 52 feet and was powered by a 1,600-horsepower Wright Cyclone engine. The plane was able to attain an airspeed of nearly 300 miles per hour and could carry either a torpedo or 2,000 pounds of bombs. The plane's crew of three consisted of pilot, a radio man, and a gunner. TBMs were responsible for some of the most decisive American naval air victories in the Pacific during World War II. Most spectacular was the sinking of the world's largest battleship, the Yamato, along with her escort consisting of the cruiser Yahagi and four destroyers. All six Japanese ships went to the bottom in less than an hour after the first Avenger spotted them. Flight 19's pre-flight weather check showed surface winds of 20 knots with gusts to 30 and scattered clouds. Although these conditions would have been rough for small boats, it was the kind of weather TBMs were built to fly in. At 2 p.m., Lieutenant Taylor's plane was airborne. 10 minutes later, the five planes with their 14 men were in formation and winging east over the Atlantic toward the wreck of a target ship just south of Bimini in the Bahamas. After making their mock torpedo runs at the concrete hulk, Flight 19 regrouped and commenced with the day's mission, a routine navigation training flight that was scheduled to take them due east for 160 miles, north for 40 miles, and then west-southwest back to their base, a triangular course that fit well into the Bermuda or Devil's Triangle. At 3:45, 15 minutes before the flight was due to land, Corporal Costner was in the barracks day room sealing a letter he had just written to his parents. 150 miles up the Florida coast at Banana River Naval Air Station, now Patrick Air Force Base, serving Cape Canaveral, Lieutenant Harry G. Cohn of Gainesville, Florida, and his crew of 12 men had just reported to the operations room. Under routine procedures, they were to stand by as the ready crew should any of the huge Martin Mariner PBM flying boats based there be needed for a search and rescue mission. The tower operators at Fort Lauderdale Naval Air Station were waiting to be relieved at 4 p.m. As the tower's chief radio man checked over his log before turning the watch over to his relief, the tower received a frantic message from Lieutenant Taylor, leading the squadron of five torpedo bombers. Quote, their disappointment was not to last for long. The blacks heaved on the block and tackle, but the big marble slab wouldn't budge. It was as if some force on the inside was causing the block to resist movement. Stonemasons checked, as we said. Finally, with the help of wooden wedges driven by sledgehammers, the block began to move up, the onlookers crouching to get a better look, then saw what had impaired the attempt to clear the entryway. That's where we were last time. I tell you what, I will not be live every week, every night this week. And if the folks in Texas and North Carolina and Virginia and Kentucky and all over this network that are going to leave me in about 3 minutes, if they don't get on the phone and call me, I will make you a guarantee. I will finish these stories and will not play the reruns in your city. But if I get some calls from these cities on whatever night that we're not live this week, I will replay the next hour or so while I finish these stories. Now, of course, you won't know which night this week that'll be. Same goes for Reno. Now, by the same token, I don't have to stay live with Augusta and with the cities that are with us. I can go home, probably make some of my voices of faith happy. But I think they have calluses in the right places. If the cause is great enough, they'll stay. I want you to wake them up. Now, I wish that all I had to do was teach. But we got a budget problem, and as the week keeps going, I do not intend to miss the opportunity to push us for $1 million. To reach $1 million, every King's House and every Gideon and every person that I teach has got to determine you'll be one in a million. You know what I'm talking about. If you don't, you shouldn't give, because I don't want anybody giving to me that I haven't taught who give for the reasons we teach. But there are a few minutes before we sign off, and I'm going to stop right here. You got to give me credit. I didn't go to the big black mass yet. Now, to get back to the crypt and back to the devil's triangle, I need to have the phone jammed for the next 7 minutes. I need to know if we're in Los Angeles. I need to know to you that are in Los Angeles, you're going to be in the King's House next Sunday. I'm looking for one of these books. I might just give one away, but I haven't been able to find it yet. I'd like to keep teaching, but you're going to have to help me. And I think that's all I should have to say. Let's continue. October 21st, 1962, was the 50th wedding anniversary of Anthony and Emma Hessler of Fort Lauderdale. I know you waited hours to hear that. October 21st, 1962, was the 50th wedding anniversary of Anthony and Emma Hessler of Fort Lauderdale. To celebrate, they took a 3-day cruise to Nassau aboard the SS Florida. I want you to know the Devil's Triangle has no mercy even on people on their 50th wedding anniversary. You say, what's this got to do with the crypt? Well, it happened in the same general territory. The point I'm making is strange things go on in the Devil's Triangle. You'll all look at me differently in the morning. The big white cruise ship sailed from Miami about 5:15 p.m. on Friday, October 19th. You might as well settle in, folks. We're going to stay here all night. Your enthusiasm overwhelms me. The big white cruise ship sailed from Miami at about 5:15 p.m. on Friday, October 19th, holding hands in its sloop. The Hesslers stood at the rail on the promenade deck. That's the one you walk on. Looking back at the vessel's wake and the Miami skyline silhouetted with the late afternoon sun, the sky was cloudless. The sea was flat, calm. The only wind was that created by the ship's movement. At approximately 7 o'clock, the Hesslers sat down at their table in the dining room for their evening meal. Happy anniversary. They had just been served their soup and salad. When suddenly, Emma Hessler found herself sitting on the deck, covered with her food. Trays of food were flying across the room. Chairs. Now try to put yourself into this scene. It's a calm day. Chairs, tables, food, and people were sliding across the dining floor. The ship had suddenly listed 45 degrees to the port. Then slowly, very slowly, on Tuesday, January 28, 1975, the Star of Peace set sail for San Salvador in the Bahamas for several weeks of cruising and diving. Some of McCulloch's business associates were to meet the vessel there. You know old McCulloch. It was good sailing weather on January 30th as the Star of Peace reached along under full sail. The rays of the subtropical winter sun appeared to be dancing on top of the waves. The air was warm. Most of the crew were lazily sitting or standing around the deck. The wind in the rigging, the sound of the sea, and the schooner's heeling hull plunged through the waves. And that was all that broke the silence of the ocean. I'm reading from Devil's Triangle 2 in case you got lost. The only machinery running was below decks, where a small air compressor was being used to fill scuba diving tanks. The vessel was under the command of Dan Smith, an executive in McCulloch's firm. Others aboard included John Messer and John and Jack Sion, both of Fort Lauderdale, Randy Seath of Merritt Island, Florida, and Jerry Baldiga of Dudley, Massachusetts. I want you to remember all these fellows. Early in the afternoon, Smith went below to check the compressor, the tank, scuba diving tank, being filled, registered only 1,500 pounds. A tank full holds 2,200 pounds of air pressure. Another 10 to 15 minutes of filling would do it. Now, the safety tolerance of the tank was over 3,000 pounds. Smith headed topside. Just as he reached the deck, now, you remember those fellows. It was daylight. The sun had not yet lifted above the horizon. The weather was clear and balmy as the motor vessel Atlantic City plied westward less than a day away from her destination, Newport News, Virginia. Morris of South Wales was on lookout duty atop the Atlantic City's bridge. Most of the crew were still sleeping. Soon it'd be time to awaken them, ready the ship for entering port. So Morris was joined by the officer of the watch, who chatted for a few minutes before returning below to the wheelhouse. Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging, and circling erratically. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great ball of fire, traveling rapidly and heading directly for the ship. It was on a collision course with the Atlantic City. Panicking, Morris began to jump over the wind dodger to the foredeck below. Put yourself in these scenes. The mate grabbed him and pulled him back to the deck. The two terrified men lay there, covering their faces. That guy didn't pull him back because he was friendly. He just didn't want to be left alone. Hearing no noise whatsoever, they looked up. The fireball was nearly upon them. Its glare made them squint. making no roar or noise whatsoever. It passed directly over the ship, clearing the mastheads by what seemed like only inches. The men leaped to their feet, but now we got the honeymooners, no, the anniversary mooners, on the floor. We got the ship at 45 degrees listing. We got something going on below deck on the Star of Peace. And we got great balls of fire terrifying the Atlantic City ship. What I said. Now, don't you think that these folks that staff late need to have the whole frame of reference before we start concluding these stories that you've been made tense with? You couldn't sleep now anyway. You might as well just settle down. In October 1954, the Coast Guard buoy tender Smilax was proceeding north from Brunswick, Georgia, to various points along the South Carolina coast. Coast Guard buoy tender, this is. This government ship. As the 100-foot-long Smilax crossed Ossabaw Sound near Savannah, she ran into a very dense fog. Seaman Second Class Ike Levine, now Master Chief Boatswain Snate, mate at the Fort Lauderdale Coast Guard Station, took over the bow watch just before midnight, once each minute. The vessel's foghorn bellowed out. I think I can tell you that one. I can hurry up along that one. In the fog, foghorns approached and passed, and when they put a searchlight out, a light shined down on their searchlight, and they couldn't find anything. I'll skip that one. It's not as exciting as the next one. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Yamacraw. Former World War II mine layer converted by the Coast Guard to combination cable laying and research ship. She had a white superstructure and a black hull. Remember that one? Large letters on her hull disclosed her designation. WARC 333. The name Yamacraw from an Indian tribe. Commanded by William D. Strouch. August 8, 1956, the Yamacraw was on a heading of 165 degrees. Her position was 30 degrees 65 north, 73.80 west, which placed her in what is sometimes referred to as the Sargasso or Seaweed Sea. It was 01:30 hours when the radar operator called out large landmass dead ahead, range 28 miles. Now, remember that Greek industrialist, he went on a diving expedition, found about 150 fathoms down, a 600-foot-high pyramid structure with an opening that was sucking things in, and down another opening, things coming out. Dr. Brown was diving, looked back toward the sun, saw a mirror-shaped pyramid almost near the surface. Saw an opening and went in. Saw a crystal in a set of metallic hands. Grabbed the crystal and swam like hell. Still has the crystal. Mayor candidate for Orlando, Florida. flying at low level to explore the bottom. Suddenly there was turbulence in the water. A trough appeared in the water. He saw a pyramid-like structure rise up, just part of it out of the water, like a periscope of a submarine cutting the water on each side. The turbulence made the waves rise on each side of the wings. Water spout updraft hit him and threw him up 1,000 feet. Now we've sat in the sea pyramids in the Bermuda Triangle area that rise out of the water, under the water. The one in Egypt is about between 400 and 500 feet tall. That one they saw, 650 feet tall. The sonar measurements on the Azores Plateau reveal a pyramid about that size. Landsat 2, taking photographs from 500 miles up, 8 dots and parallel lines, 4 on each side, low-lying airplanes in the Amazon jungle of Peru, checking out the dots, find there are 12 instead of 8, and they're giant pyramid structures, almost the height of the ones in Egypt, not yet explored. So all of this is what we've been looking at, right? Now, all these strange happenings, including the 4 anniversary mooners, great balls of fire, passing foghorns and strange lights in the fog. And it is recorded, they've tried to explain it through history, that just before Columbus sighted land, there was a strange glow he saw in the sky above the water. They tried to explain it as Indians burning some fires in their canoes offshore. You've got to be awful dumb to build a fire in your canoe out in the ocean.